Our show this week is about Gaza. It is taken from the web. Some of it is coming from social media such as TikTok, others from Facebook, and so on. I've attributed what I'm able to, and some of it is unattributed, but this is all about Gaza and all relevant in one way or another. Some of it is background, historical background, and some is very current. Okay, about Gaza. In the next clip, Israeli historian Ilan Pappe explains that the modern Jewish Zionist movement actually began with a Christian Zionist movement in England.
Zionism began as a project of evangelical Christianity long before Jewish intellectuals suggested the idea of creating a Jewish state in Palestine, and the motivation was anti-Semitic. In the vision of evangelical Christianity, could not have the end of time, the resurrection of the dead, the return of the Messiah, without the return of the Jews to Palestine. But it created a good pretext to encourage the idea that the Jews should not live either in the United States or in Europe. So I used to call it the double bill for anti-Semites, because they get rid of the Jews, and so to speak, they get back the only Jew they want, which is Jesus Christ. This kind of group was very important among the British policymakers. Lord Balfour, who is behind the Balfour Declaration, was a very known anti-Semite. His greatest worry was that anti-Semitism in Russia would push hundreds of thousands of Jews into Britain. So he legislated in 1906 the Aliens Act in the British Parliament that was specifically meant to disallow refugees from Russia to come to Britain. Not surprisingly, when he began his connection with the Zionist movement, he saw even a better solution than trying by force to prevent Jews from Eastern Europe to come to Britain. It was better to reorientate them to Palestine. On top of it, he was told by British imperialist strategists that a Jewish Palestine would justify the integration or the incorporation of Palestine within the British Empire.
And coming up next, Israeli Professor of History Ilan Pappe addresses a number of points that are relevant to the current situation.
They would not listen to you in America if you are a Palestinian historian, but they would listen to you if you are an Israeli Jewish historian. Israeli troops poisoned the water of Acre, in order to make the city surrender. What we found in the archives is that from the mid-1930s, and definitely immediately after the Second World War, the Zionist political and military leadership contemplated and planned mass expulsion of Palestinians in order to create what they thought would be a Jewish democratic state. They wanted as much of Palestine as possible, with as few Palestinians in it as possible. Their main problem in 1947, 1948, when the British rule came to an end, was that the Jews in Palestine were only one-third of the population. And even when the United Nations took over the issue of Palestine from Britain and suggested to partition Palestine into an Arab state and a Jewish state in November 1947, the demographics were such that even in the Jewish state that was offered by the United Nations, the Jews were still not the majority, because there were too few Jews in Palestine in 47-48. And the solution, definitely after the Second World War, in the eyes of the leading Zionist politicians and military commanders, was very clear. What I called in my book of 2007, the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. The decision to expel massively the Palestinians from any area that would become the Jewish state eventually was taken in March, in the beginning of March 1948. That is 2 months before the Arab armies entered Palestine. And we wrote a story that most Israelis found very disturbing. We said, actually,
the Arab armies entered Palestine because the Zionist movement was already expelling Palestinians for 2 months. And these Palestinian refugees began to reach the Arab capitals. And there was a pressure by Arab public opinion on the Arab governments to do something, especially after the Deir Yassin massacre on the 9th of April 1948, which was broadcast all over the Arab world. It was not the only massacre. So we described a sequence of events by which we said, actually, the Palestinians did not become refugees because of the war. They became refugees because the Zionist movement planned their massive expulsion, what I called the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Ethnic cleansing is a crime against humanity. And it was very systematically planned. In March 48, the army adopted something called Plan D, or Plan Daled. And according to that plan, Palestine was divided into areas, and each brigade of the Jewish Zionist army, later became the Israeli army, had the list of villages to occupy and to destroy and to expel. If you go to the documents, you can see that the Israeli army orders the troops in 1948 to occupy the enemy bases, to destroy them, and to expel the enemy outside of the country. Now, if you are a bit open-minded and you think in the 1980s about the occupation of the West Bank, if you think about the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, then you say, wait a minute, what is this base? Is it a military bunker with outpost, with regular soldiers, armed soldiers, or is it a village? It turns out it's a village. And that the enemy troops are babies, women, old men, and some soldiers. But they are all together the enemy. And therefore, the destruction of the base is the demolition of a village. And the killing of the enemy could be a massacre of civilians. And if you want to understand the Israeli narrative, you have to look at the map that this atlas has on the 1948 war. You can see thick, huge arrows coming from the Arab world into Palestine, and you need a very good eyesight to detect the Israeli arrow that comes to meet them. You understand what the image conveys, right? So we did something very simple. We counted troops, which we're not supposed to do, apparently, because we found out that there were more Israeli soldiers than Arab soldiers in the 48 war. So it was not exactly David and Goliath. Maybe there were two Davids, semi-Davids, semi-Goliaths, I don't know, whatever you want. But it was not a David and Goliath. Not only that, we found out that the Israeli army was far better equipped in terms of arms, far better trained. But I don't want to underestimate the fact that there was a war between Israel and contingents from the Arab neighboring Arab states who entered Palestine on the 15th of May 1948, the day that the British mandate or rule over Palestine ended. And this was a war. This was a proper war. People were killed on both sides. One should say that. In the case of Israel and Palestine, because Zionism is a settler colonialist movement, namely, it's a project that has not been completed. Something which I think is very important to understand. The late Edward Said said, and I think that was a very poignant idea that he had, he said, if in 1948 the ethnic cleansing of Palestine would have stopped, if it would be one event, one-off event, as terrible as it was, it would have been possible to build a new kind of reality in the relationship between Jews and Arabs. But he said it didn't stop in 1948. Between 1948 and 1967, Israel expelled 36 villages in order to downsize the number of Palestinians within the Jewish state. When Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, it expelled 300,000 Palestinians. Three refugee camps near Jericho were emptied. The Muslim quarter in Jerusalem near the Wailing Wall was emptied. Since 1967 until today, another 250,000 Palestinians were expelled in various means from the West Bank. And the expulsion, the ethnic cleansing, continues as we speak. Sometimes it's just one Palestinian a day, sometimes it's more. But the main issue is that the Israeli notion of democracy is totally connected to demography. Namely, you cannot have a proper democracy unless you have a clear Jewish majority. And all the means are justified to get this majority. Massacre, ethnic cleansing, inducing people to leave, not allowing them to return. It's all part of the same methodology to sustain a democracy on the basis of racist demography. I remember I was in Washington with Noam Chomsky, and there were two members of the House of Representatives who were willing to meet us, but they only were willing to meet us in this tunnel that connects the two houses. So I mean, we need to get these people out of the tunnel and say, come on, nothing's going to happen to you. Let's meet in the coffee house above the tunnel.
That was Israeli Professor of History Ilan Pape. Next up, we have Noam Chomsky with some observations about the relationship between Israel and the United States.
Why does the United States support Israel? Well, there's a history, and a very interesting one, that actually goes back to a long time. One thing to remember is that Christian Zionism is a very powerful force, which goes back long before Jewish Zionism. In England, particularly, Christian Zionism was a powerful force among British elites. It's part of the motivation for the Balfour Declaration and for Britain's support for Jewish colonization of Israel. Remember, the Bible said, you know, and that's a big part of British elite culture. Same in the United States. Woodrow Wilson was a devout Christian who read the Bible every day. So did Harry Truman. In the Roosevelt administration, one of the leading officials, Harold Ickes, once described the return of the Jews to Palestine as the greatest event in history. It's realizing the lesson of the Bible. These are deeply religious countries in which the biblical commands, so-called, are taken quite literally. Also, this is just part of colonization. This is the last phase of European colonization. And notice that the countries that are most strongly in support of Israel are not just the United States. It's the United States, Australia, and Canada, the offshoots of England, Anglosphere sometimes called. Unusual forms of imperialism. These are settler colonial societies. Societies in which not like India, not like the British in India, say. Societies, South Africa is a little like this, or Algeria under the French. Settler colonial societies in which the settlers came in, essentially eliminated the native population. Also driven by religious principles, very religious groups driven by Christian Zionism. Those are major cultural factors. There are also significant geostrategic factors. And you go back to 1948, there was actually a split between the State Department and the Pentagon in the United States over how to react to the new state of Israel. The State Department was not committed strongly to Israeli conquests, the establishment of the state, and was concerned about the refugees. It wanted an implementation of the refugee problem. The Pentagon, on the other hand, was very impressed with Israel's military potential. The Israeli military successes, if you look back at the internal record and declassified, the Joint Chiefs of Staff described Israel as the second largest military force in the region after Turkey and a potential base for U.S. power in the region. That continued can't run through the whole record, but in 1958, when there was a serious crisis in the region, Israel was the only state that strongly cooperated with Britain and the United States, and it won plenty of support from the governments and the military for that reason. 1967 is when the current relations with Israel were pretty much established. Israel performed a major service to the United States by destroying a secular Arab nationalism, a major enemy of the United States, and supporting radical Islam, which the U.S. supported. And it continues right until the present. Right now, we saw an example of that just during the latest Gaza attack. You recall that at one point, Israel began to run out of munitions during the assault, despite the fact that it's armed to the teeth. The United States provided Israel with additional munitions through the Pentagon. And notice where they were taken from. These were U.S. munitions pre-positioned in Israel for eventual use by U.S. forces. One of many signs of how Israel is regarded as essentially a military offshoot of the United States. Very close intelligence relations that go way back. Many other connections. And the media tend to take up to support the policy of the government with very few, you know, kind of little questioning around the edges, but basically accept the policy. So, for example, take another issue. Take the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You cannot find the phrase U.S. invasion of Iraq in the U.S. media. That was obviously an invasion, a blatant act of aggression, a textbook case of that's Nuremberg trials called the supreme international crime, cannot be mentioned. President Obama is praised as an opponent of the invasion. And what did he say? He said it's a mistake. It's a strategic blunder. We're not going to get away with it. That's the kind of opposition that you heard from the German general staff during Hitler's invasion of Russia. It's a blunder. Shouldn't do it. We should knock off England first. That's regarded as opposition. Same in Vietnam. There's now a commemoration underway, big commemoration of U.S. sacrifices in Vietnam. Try to find the phrase U.S. invasion of South Vietnam there or anywhere in the past year since 1961 when it took place. Non-existent, maybe on Democracy Now, what I write, but way out at the fringe. And this is not unique to the United States. Take, say, Britain. Right now there's interesting debates in the British literary journals, like the Times Literary Supplement, as to whether Britain should finally begin to recognize the genocidal, the word that's used, genocidal character of British colonization hundreds of years ago. Should Britain begin to face it? You know, you can ask that question in many places. The tendency of the intellectual community to go along like a herd in support of state power, private power, is just overwhelming. Intellectuals like to think of themselves as dissident, critical, courageous, standing up against power. Absolutely untrue. You look at the historical record, that's a small fringe, and they're usually punished. The mainstream tends to be what was once called a herd of independent minds, marching in support of state power. Nothing new here. Unfortunate, you have to fight against it, not new.
Next, we have Professor John Mearsheimer addressing an audience about the situation in Gaza. He is speaking on October 23rd, 2023.
What the United States has been interested in doing is creating a Palestinian state in the West Bank and in Gaza and in East Jerusalem, living next door to a Jewish state, Israel. We have failed. We have not been able to push the Israelis to accept that, and there's no two-state solution. So what the Israelis now have, and which the government in Israel wants, is Greater Israel. Greater Israel includes the West Bank, Gaza, and 1967 Israel, or Green Line Israel. Okay, that's Greater Israel. The key point you want to keep in mind is that there are approximately 7.3 million Palestinians and approximately 7.3 million Israeli Jews in Greater Israel. There is rough equality between Palestinians and Israeli Jews. You just want to think about that. So when you think about Israel, and you think about Israel as the Jewish state, which is completely understandable, you want to understand that that Jewish state has as many Palestinians in it as it has Jews. And by the way, there's a very prominent demographic expert who is Israeli who argues that there are slightly more Palestinians than there are Jews inside Greater Israel. And furthermore, when you look at demographic trends over time, there are going to be more Palestinians than there are Jews. And this is a Jewish state. So the question is, what do you do here? And what has happened is that the Israelis do not want to give equal rights to the Palestinians. Because if they gave equal rights to the Palestinians, Israel would soon cease to be a Jewish state, because there are more Palestinians than there are Jews, if not now, certainly in the future. So in the case of the Palestinians who are in Gaza, right, basically they have been cordoned off. They have been isolated in Gaza. And it is commonplace to refer to Gaza as the largest open-air prison in the world. And if you read virtually any account of what life is like for those Palestinians who live in Gaza, it is absolutely horrible. There is just no question about that. They live under horrible conditions, in effect, in a prison. You want to understand that Israel controls the borders around Gaza and it controls the air above Gaza. These are not disputable issues. And again, there are about 2.1 million of those 7.3 million Palestinians in Gaza. And the fact is that the Israelis, who have been playing hardball with the Palestinian since 1948, when the State of Israel was created, are in a situation where the Palestinians are going to erupt from time to time. Most of us in this audience have heard of the First Intifada. We have heard of the Second Intifada. The Intifadas were uprisings by the Palestinians. The Palestinians want their own nation state, just as the Jews wanted their own nation state. It's perfectly understandable that the Zionists were interested in coming to Palestine and creating a Jewish state, a Jewish nation state. That's completely understandable. But as my mother taught me when I was a little boy, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And if the Jews want their own nation state, are you surprised that the Palestinians want their own nation state? No. And American policymakers, especially American presidents, going back to Jimmy Carter, understood this completely and should have put enormous pressure on Israel to accept the two-state solution. But we were incapable of doing that. We could not put great pressure on Israel. And the end result is you have a greater Israel. And inside that greater Israel are 7.3 million Palestinians. And just to take this a step further, it's very controversial to refer to Israel as an apartheid state, given how they treat the Palestinians. But Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and B'Tselem is one of the leading human rights groups in the world, and it's an Israeli human rights group. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and B'Tselem all have produced significant reports that label Israel as an apartheid state. So this is the reality that you now face. And the problem is there is no way the Israelis are ever going to agree to a two-state solution. because the political center of gravity in Israel has moved far to the right over time and is likely to move further to the right over time. If you look at the Israeli demographic situation, Israeli women have large numbers of babies compared to Western birth rates. But your average ultra-Orthodox woman has about 7 babies. So what's happening is that the ultra-Orthodox, who now represent 13% of the population, will probably represent about 30% of the population in 2050 or 2060. They're growing significantly in number. And the ultra-Orthodox, I mean, they're a problem for a variety of reasons for Israel, because first of all, they don't serve in the military. Secondly, the husbands don't work and, in effect, live on welfare. But furthermore, their politics are far to the right. The ultra-Orthodox are not going to be sympathetic to a two-state solution. Furthermore, after what happened on October 7th, what do you think the Israelis are going to say when you say, let's move towards a two-state solution? They're going to look at you like you're crazy, given what happened on October 7th. So all of this is just to say, the only hope, in my opinion, of ever settling this conflict between the Palestinians and the Jews inside of Greater Israel was a two-state solution. And a two-state solution is not going to happen. That train has left the station.
And that was Professor John Mearsheimer speaking on October 23rd, 2023. This is Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita. He's speaking from Gaza.
So the internet just came back this morning. I'm okay. It was a hell of a night, I have to say. I certain points, I thought that was the end of it. We had a kid who has obviously been burnt with phosphorus. And phosphorus is a chemical burn that continues to burn. The bomb explodes mid-air and it showers with pellets of phosphorus that continue to burn when they hit the flesh until they're doused with water continuously or they're cut out. And it has a distinctive burn because it just burrows right into the deepest parts of the body. The artillery bombardment has not stopped throughout the whole night, and now more and more kids with the phosphorus burns and more wounded. We've run out of morphine. What we give people is really inadequate, especially after surgery. Everybody's getting paracetamol and another non-steroidal. There's no morphine around, certainly not for the number of injured. The nurses are so stretched just looking after these patients after the surgery. I'm trying to figure out what the military strategy is other than killing, but there isn't. There are now 3,200 children killed. So the internet just...
Hanan Ashrawi is a Palestinian Christian politician and a civic activist. Here she's being interviewed by the BBC.
I wonder if you do have to acknowledge the barbarity, the brutality of the attack on Israelis in southern Israel by Hamas before this can move forwards.
Oh, God. I mean, I can't believe I'm hearing the same thing over and over again. This is a preoccupation with the Western media, because something happened to Israel for the first time in its history. Everybody's up in arms, and its victims have to condemn themselves. Israel has been doing this to us for decades. Piecemeal, day in, day out, people killed, homes demolished. And we're telling you how many Palestinians have been killed by a brutal Israeli occupation. Total siege in Gaza, total destruction and land theft in the West Bank. Nobody brings Hamas spokespeople, Israeli spokespeople, and say, do you condemn this? Isn't this brutal? Isn't this genocide? Isn't this? No. But the moment people under siege, look at Gaza. It's an area where people haven't had a day of normal life. And then when they lash out, when they break out, immediately, all sorts of horrific labels are used.
Were the Israeli citizens legitimate targets?
The problem is using, as I said, this logic.
I just want to be clear. I just want to be clear. Are you saying that the Israeli citizens were legitimate targets?
No, I don't believe in civilians being legitimate targets at all. At all. In the same way as we are not legitimate targets of Israel. Our homes, our lands are not at its disposal. Our freedom, our rights have been denied. No, don't put words in my mouth.
Okay.
Never. Civilians are never legitimate targets. But what I'm talking about is the double standard.
Okay.
Israel is an occupying power. This has to be acknowledged. Israel has been torturing the Palestinians since 1947. It is time this stops.
And that was Palestinian politician Hanan Ashrawi. And here is Judith Butler, who is an American philosopher and gender studies scholar.
We actually need a much fuller political. Well, let me simply say that everyone on this show who you have interviewed in Palestine has used the word genocide, and I think we need to take this word quite seriously because it does describe the situation in which a population is targeted, not just the military part, but the civilian part, and bombarded, dislocated forcibly, and plans are being made for relocation or the absolute razing of Gaza itself. So, as you know, there are legal groups like the Center for Constitutional Rights that has published a 40-page study on why it is correct to call what is happening to Palestinians now genocide. And other groups are studying international law and showing that genocide is not, it doesn't always look like the Nazi regime, but it can be the systematic undercutting of the livelihood, the health, the well-being, and the capacity to persist. This is exactly what is happening. Why it is that the U.S. media, for the most part, and the U.S. government has decided to be complicit with genocidal crimes a major question. It is an alarming fact, and Hanan Ashrawi is right to say that it's not just that they're giving ideological support or spin doctors to say that Israeli genocidal violence is justified. They are actually giving weapons and support and counsel in order to effect this genocidal set of policies. So as far as I'm concerned, the Palestinians have been labeled as ungrievable. That is to say, they're not a group of people whose lives are being considered as worthy of value, of persisting, of flourishing in this world. If they are lost, it is not considered to be a true loss because they are not just less than human, surely that, but not just less than human, but a threat to what the idea of the human is that is being defended by Zionist politics shared by Israel and the U.S. and many Western powers. So I think once we see these caricatures taking hold in public discourse, all Palestinians are Hamas, or Hamas is terrorist rather than, say, an armed resistance struggle, or Israeli violence is morally justified, and Palestinian violence is barbaric. Well, why wouldn't it be right to describe the bombardment of people in their homes and in their hospitals and in their schools, or as they are fleeing, according to Israeli directives? Why isn't that barbaric? I mean, what we are seeing is not just the killing of Palestinian civilian lives as a casualty of war, a kind of byproduct. These civilians are targeted. So the targeting of civilians who belong to a particular group, ethnic, racially defined, that is a genocidal practice. That is what we are seeing. And we should all be standing up and objecting and calling for an end to genocide. It's true. I signed several petitions, one of which calls for an immediate ceasefire. That's the minimum. But the fact is that the violence that we're seeing belongs to a longstanding violence, 75-year-old violence that has been characterized by systematic dislocation, killing, imprisonment, detention, stolen land, damaged lives. We actually need a much fuller political solution to the situation. Until Palestine is free and people in Palestine are able to live as citizens or political actors in a world that they help to craft, they become self-governing, they belong to a democracy, we will continue to see violence. We will continue to see this structural violence producing this kind of resistance.
And that was American philosopher Judith Butler. Coming up, Craig Mookhiver. He's the former head of the UN Human Rights Office.
Usually the most difficult part of proving genocide is intent, because there has to be an intention to destroy in whole or in part a particular group. In this case, the intent by Israeli leaders has been so explicitly stated and publicly stated by the Prime Minister, by the President, by senior cabinet ministers, by military leaders, that is an easy case to make. It's on the public record. If we can allege that we see war crimes, crimes against humanity, as we have often done, there's no reason to exclude, where we see very strong evidence, the possibility of genocide being committed. And I think you're going to be hearing that term more and more in connection with what we're witnessing in Gaza. I feel quite confident as a human rights lawyer in saying that what I see unfolding in Gaza and beyond is genocide.
Craig Mookhiver, former head of the UN Human Rights Office. Next, some comments regarding the Israeli army by Israeli activist and author Miko Peled.
And then you've got the Israeli army, which I like to refer to as one of the best trained, best equipped, best fed terrorist organizations in the world. And yes, they have generals and they have nice uniforms, but their entire purpose is terrorism. And just as one example, I'll give you one example. Almost exactly 4 years ago, as Israel began its attack on Gaza, September the 27th, 2008, at 11:25 in the morning, what I refer to as the most shameful day in the Jewish history, the most shameful day in the history of the Jewish people. Israel began carpet bombing Gaza, and on the first day of what was to be a 21-day attack, they dropped 100 tons of bombs. Okay, a one-ton bomb will decimate an entire city block. Gaza is one of the most densely populated places in the world. 800,000 children live in Gaza. 11:25 is exactly the time when the morning school shift and the afternoon school shift change. So all the kids are in the streets. All the children are on the streets. That was the moment decided by the decision makers in Israel to begin the attack. This was the first day of a 21-day slaughter that had absolutely no justification. If that's not terrorism, I don't know what is. And then you've got the Israeli army, which I like to refer to as one of the most...
And that was Israeli author Miko Peled. And here we have a former Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, former IDF soldier explaining what his patrols were like.
1,000 Palestinians live in Hebron. It's a unique city by that it's the only Palestinian city as a whole, if you put aside East Jerusalem, that has an Israeli settlement in the heart of the city. So you have 850 settlers living in a city center of 180,000 Palestinians, Guarding them, you have 650 combat soldiers on a day-to-day basis, and I was one of these 650 soldiers for a while. So what do? You make your presence felt. How does it look like? You have two military patrols. One is in charge of the old city of Hebron. The other one is in charge of Palestinian neighborhoods around the old city. And that's their job, to make their presence felt. You start your night shift patrol 10 o'clock till 6 o'clock in the morning, 8-hour shift. Walk in the streets of the old city. Break into a house. It's not a house we have intelligence about. A random house. I'm the sergeant, I lead the patrol. Choose a random house, break into the house, wake up the family. Men one side, women the other side, search the place. You can yourself imagine the dynamics. What happens when you break into a family, 2 o'clock at night, wake everyone up. Search the place, finish, go out to the street, knock on some doors, make some noise, run to the other corner of the street, invade another house, wake up the family, search, go out, run to the other corner of the old.
That was the voice of a former Israel Defense Forces soldier. Coming up next, we have a 10-minute talk by Dr. Gabor Mate, a psychologist. He's speaking on the reason why our society is so toxic.
When we look around this society, and from the perspective of health, what do we see? We see that 50% of adults in this society, which considers itself the most successful society in the history of the world, actually suffers from some chronic illness, heart disease, high blood pressure, cancer, whatever, autoimmune disease, whatever it happens to be. 50% of adolescents today are now set to meet the diagnostic criteria for one or another mental health condition. There are 3.5 million children in this country who are receiving stimulant medications for ADHD. In the United States, the antipsychotics, risperidone and Seroquel, I think are in the top four to six prescriptions given out in this country, not to mention the antidepressants. But if we understand that human beings' physiology is affected by their relationships, then we see that when stress happens, cortisol elevates in the body, which is a stress hormone, which suppresses the immune system. Adrenaline increases in the body, which disorganizes the nervous system. In the short term, they help you fight back or to escape, but in the long term, they actually can suppress the body. No wonder then that people are isolated and stressed are more likely to develop disease, which is to say that the disease is not simply a manifestation of some physical process unique to them, but it reflects their particular lives in a particular environment, in a particular culture. So when I talk about the toxic culture that a materialistic society offers its members, what am I referring to? Well, materialism is really a system of belief or behavior which considers material things, and particularly the control and possession of material things, is more important than human values such as connection, love, or spiritual values such as recognizing the unity of everything. And that's the kind of culture we live in. Interestingly enough, the religious right, in their opposition to the very idea of climate change or to the idea that the environment is important to look at, they will quote the Old Testament where man is given stewardship over the earth and all other creatures. But when they talk about stewardship, they mean control and dominance. There's another way to look at stewardship, which is caring and nurturing for, looking after. And in the materialistic sense, it's that control and ownership that we look at. And that means that the culture itself, quite apart from the physical toxins that we spew into the environment and the way in which we're altering the very air that we breathe and the very sun that beats down on us, we actually are affected also by the toxicity of human relationships or the lack of human relationships that this kind of a society that emphasizes material values teaches us to pursue. And from that perspective, we have to understand that medicine is not simply a science. It's much more than that. It's also an ideology. It's a way of looking at human beings. So when we look at human beings as individuals without understanding the importance of their social relationships and their emotional, psychological interactions with others, that's actually a manifestation of the individualistic perspective of the entrepreneur who says that only I matter and what I gain or what I control matters, and we're all in competition with one another. So you see that economic ideological perspective also showing up in its own particular way in the practice of medicine. Well, reality is totally different. Reality tells us that we can't be separated. And this begins already in pregnancy. So a study out of Johns Hopkins University in 2004, for example, showed that the reactivity to stress of the fetus is affected by the stress, depression, or anxiety of the mother. So when you look at the heartbeat and the movement of infants in the womb, whose mothers are stressed, depressed, or anxious, you see different patterns of activity. And that will have lifetime effects. So this mind-body unity and this interaction of the environment and the individual begins already in the womb. A report out of Harvard earlier this year talked about the impact of toxic stress on children. And these children who experienced toxic stress on the part, because the environment was stressed, because their parents were highly stressed, or dysfunctional, or abusive, later on in life, there is significantly increased risk of heart disease, obesity, diabetes mellitus, high blood pressure, and a whole list of other medical conditions. And from that same perspective again, when we look at something like the obesity epidemic, which has 30% of kids in the United States overweight now, significantly overweight, it's not a food problem. Well, it is a food problem, the junk foods and all that. But it's mostly a stress problem, because what people do is they soothe their stresses, like any addiction, they soothe their stresses with their addictive behaviors. And those junk foods work in the short term because they release feel-good hormones in the brain. So if you want to look at children and prevent obesity, it's not enough to tell them not to eat junk foods or to get more exercise. You have to say, what's lacking in their lives that they're so stressed, that they have to soothe themselves in that particular way? And what's lacking in their lives, of course, are human relationships that are nurturing and supportive. Again, not because the parents are not trying to do their best, but because the parents are trying to do their best under impossible circumstances. If you look at what actually triggers stress, the significant factors that trigger stress are uncertainty, lack of information, and loss of control. Now, what happens in a culture where the economy is going on a tube, where decisions are made far away by people who don't even know you and you don't know who they are, and your life is very much affected by these large forces over which you have increasingly a sense that you have no control or even influence over? Well, that means a lot of people are going to be stressed. A lot of uncertainty. A lot of people are going to be stressed. And that stress then will lead to addictive behaviors. That stress then will lead to parents passing that stress on to their children. In the 19th century, Karl Marx talked about alienation, which is a separation, being a stranger to something. And you're an alien to something. And Marx said there were four alienations in this culture. One is we alienated from nature. At a conference dedicated to looking at the physical and the natural environment, I don't have to say much to you to show how alienated we are from nature when we're destroying nature itself. The second alienation is from other people. And that means we have less contact, we have less intimacy, we have less trust, we have less of a sense of relationship. And that, of course, as I've shown you, leads to increased propensity to illness, physical and mental. We are alienated from our work. A lot of people no longer do work that has any meaning to them. And that means that, and since human beings are productive creatures, we really are created in the image of God. We're meant to create. When we do work that's not creative, that doesn't reflect who we are, that imposes depression, anxiety, a sense of meaninglessness. And when we have a sense of meaninglessness, we'll want to substitute that sense of meaninglessness or that sense of meaning that we've lost by all kinds of other activities. And then we get all hung up on how we look or how people feel about us, what we can obtain, what we can possess, what successes we can achieve. In other words, all the false substitutes which cannot possibly compensate us for the lack of genuine meaning. Finally, and most importantly, we become alienated from ourselves. How many of you had the following experience? That you had a powerful gut feeling about something, you didn't pay attention to it, and you were sorry afterwards. Well, that means to say, now you know what are you telling me? You're telling me that at some point in your childhood, you got separated from yourself. Because no infant is born without gut feelings. Infants are totally connected to their gut feelings. That in this culture, something very powerful happens to alienate you from your true self because the world couldn't stand who you really were. And your parents were too stressed themselves to honor and recognize who you really were. Just as a parent, I did that to my kids without meaning to. And then we become alien from ourselves. We shut down our gut feelings. And our gut feelings are not luxuries, you know. They tell us what is right and what is wrong. They tell us what is dangerous and what is friendly. They tell us what is safe and what is dangerous. And they tell us what is true and what is false. So when we're alienated from our gut feelings, we have no longer have a sense of reality, no longer have a sense of truth. Well, the good news is that human beings can regain their sense of connection to themselves, just as we can regain our sense of connection to our nature. And empathy, which is a genuine human quality, is in us. We're actually wired for empathy. That's our nature as human beings. So contrary to the myth in our culture, that we're separated, individual, aggressive, competitive creatures. We're actually wired for empathy, wired for connection, wired for love, wired for compassion. So really, to move forward, all we have to do... All we have to do, not an easy task, but it's certainly available to us, is to get back to our true nature. Thank you.
Next is a Palestinian-American man speaking to the city council at Akron, Ohio.
I half of the 3,457 children killed in 3 weeks. I am quite possibly the only one in this room who has reported as a journalist from Gaza. In August 2nd of 2014, I was walking down the streets of Shajaiya, a village that is currently leveled to the ground in eastern Gaza. And I met a young man, 17 years old, his name was Alaa Balata. I met him 2 days after his entire family was wiped out by an Israeli tank shell on July 29, 2014. And I met him as he was scraping the flesh of his family off the wall. I know what genocide looks like. And yet I'm here to tell you that on October 7th, the first person I called was a friend of mine in Israel who refused to serve in the Israeli military because he did not want to occupy my people. And this friend of mine, Haggai, spent 2 years in prison for that. When I met Alaa, and he realized who I was and where I came from. He asked me, he said, in a state of shock, no doubt. You could see, I don't know if anyone has seen a person who has gone through that kind of trauma. They don't process it for a while. But Alaa looked at me with his 17-year-old eyes and he said to me, why? Why do Americans support this? And I think today, I pray to God that Alaa is still alive. I really do. But the chances of him being dead are too high, dear Council of Akron. And you must condemn what is being done with our tax dollars today. And you must do it not just because it's the right thing. You must do it because it is written into your DNA as a city. Down the street, there is a John Brown house. Down the street, there is a John Brown house. And 20 years after John Brown was hanged by our federal government, Frederick Douglass stood in front of a crowd and he said, they could kill him, but they could not answer him. Answer the 3,457 children in Gaza. Answer them. Stand up for what's right. Free Palestine.
Thank you. Are you at home watching what's happening? It seems like a movie, right? It's not. It's real. The blood, the cries for help, the tears, it's all real. Your family and loved ones, are they safe at home? Let's strip down all the labels, titles, differences, and masks. What remains eventually is our shared humanity. You see, I can see lots of humans, but I can't seem to find humanity. Because there's no humanity in watching children butchered. There's no humanity in starving 2.2 million people. There's no humanity in whipping out 70,000 homes. There's no humanity in caging an entire city. There's no humanity with annihilating entire families. There's no humanity when kids watch their families getting murdered. There's no humanity in us watching a war crime in silence.